It's Tuesday, November 19, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. 150 years ago today, President Abraham Lincoln went to the little town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, there to dedicate what became a national cemetery. That little Pennsylvania town had been the scene of the bloodiest battle in North American history just a matter of a very short time before. That battle is now known to have been the decisive turning point in the Civil War, but at the time it was known for its gruesomeness, with total casualties on both the Union and Confederate sides now estimated to have been over 20,000 dead and wounded. The President of the United States went to that cemetery in order to declare not only a dedication, but to offer his vision of what the battle and the war meant for America. He began his speech with those immortal words 47 years ago, referring back then to 1776 and the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The president was not even expected to be the major speaker for the occasion. That was the Honorable Edward Everett, who, before the president spoke, delivered a two-hour address of over 13,000 words, a model of Victorian oratory. Only after Everett's address did the president of the United States stand, and as he unfolded his speech and grabbed his lapel, according to observers, he then delivered a speech that was only about 300 words long, actually slightly less, depending on the version, and he delivered it in just a few moments. As a matter of fact, many who were there did not believe that the speech would be memorable or would make history. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of the Civil War, James McPherson, said bluntly, quote, "No one was looking for him to make history," end quote. But make history he did. Reporter Hillel Atali, looking back for the Associated Press 150 years later, writes, "No definitive edition exists of the speech that countless children have memorized. Praise for Abraham Lincoln's language has far exceeded any attempts to emulate it, and anniversaries have been marked only sporadically by Lincoln's successors, including President Barack Obama, a self-styled Lincoln admirer who will not attend today's 150th anniversary gathering," end quote. The president's remarks were simply indicated as remarks of dedication, and the president was not expected to give a major speech, and even after he had delivered what is now one of the most famous speeches in world history, those who were there were not certain they had heard a great speech, or even a speech at all. As a matter of fact, the newspaper in neighboring Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, known as the Harrisburg Patriot and Union, declared that the president's remarks were a failure. Last week, the newspaper, now known as the Patriot News of Harrisburg, retracted the comments, saying that the newspaper's 1863 coverage amounted to, quote, "silly remarks that should now be lost behind a veil of oblivion." The president's remarks, however, continue to live in the American memory and in the American heart. Historian Alan Gelzo, one of the premier historians of the Civil War and of the Battle of Gettysburg, writes that the long story is that no single American utterance has had the staying power or commanded the respect and reverence accorded the Gettysburg Address. It has been engraved on the south wall of the Lincoln Memorial. It has been translated and analyzed in at least 9 book-length critical studies over the last century. But if the people who heard the president's remarks 150 years ago today were not at first certain that they had heard a great speech, the speech began to grow in terms of its place in the American heart almost immediately thereafter, such that Americans 150 years ago, especially those in the North, began immediately to recognize that President Abraham Lincoln had begun to redefine the nation, looking ahead to the end of the Civil War, even as he stood at the cemetery marking that gruesome battle. As Professor Gelzo writes, Lincoln's task at Gettysburg was to persuade his hearers on the evidence offered by 3 days of battle that democracy's sun had not set after all. Historian Gary Wills would later remark that all modern political prose descends from the Gettysburg Address. There was a very significant break that was represented by Lincoln's short speech. Victorian speeches tended to be very long, like Edward Everett's two-hour oration of over 13,000 words. But when the president spoke less than 300 words and spoke for just a few moments, he offered an imagery, a power of language, and a moral persuasion that began to shape the American conscience and character almost immediately. He began speaking in what some might later describe as sound bites, but much more than that. There were 10 sentences in the Gettysburg Address in terms of the most standard manuscript, and yet those 10 sentences are filled with very complex argumentation. Alan Gopnik, for instance, points out that the cadence of the Gettysburg Address is very much like the cadence of the King James Bible. Others have tried to point to classical literature, such as Pericles' funeral oration, as previous examples well known to Lincoln. But what Lincoln was doing was genuinely new. As many students of political and historical oratory have noted, what Lincoln did 150 years ago today in the Gettysburg Address also found resonance in the approach to leadership taken by Winston Churchill during the Second World War. Very powerful phrases, as Churchill would say, using the simple power of the English sentence in order to put the language to war. Lincoln intended to look beyond the war itself. He was the president who had to preside over the nation's greatest internal conflict, a conflict that had its bloodiest moment at the very battlefield where this cemetery was now to be commemorated. When the president looked back to 1776, he was saying that America's founders had founded something worth continuing, and that, even on the other side of this bloody conflict, the values that had been established in 1776 must survive. As the New York Times editorial published over the weekend makes appropriately clear, what the president did was summarized, if nothing else, in his use of two words with immediate power. Those words were here and now. Now, Lincoln says, as the editors wrote, we are engaged in a great civil war. It is now that resonates. So does the word here. Lincoln uses it 8 times, 7 in the last paragraph. The brave men who struggled here. The living crowd that is dedicated here. Is finishing the work of the honored dead, and Lincoln spoke of himself and his hearers as those who here highly resolve that this nation shall not perish from the earth. 150 years later, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address points to his role as what Elton Trueblood called America's theologian of American anguish. President Lincoln's own spiritual and theological commitments are very difficult to pin down, but his understanding of America in terms of the purposes of God was abundantly clear, never more clear than in the Gettysburg Address. And as for its influence in America and beyond, I turn back to Alan Gelzo. In an article published just before the last 4th of July, Gelzo wrote this, among my great-grandfather's papers, carefully set down in his small, gnarled handwriting, is a copy of the Gettysburg Address. When Lincoln delivered the speech, my great-grandfather was 10 years old and living in Sweden, the illegitimate son of an aristocrat. That inconvenient birth exposed him to the haphazardness of privilege, for although he was raised, petted, and groomed by his father's family, he soon understood that he would never have any real standing in that family or their world. Over their protests, he left Sweden in his 20s, arriving penniless in New York in 1879, but still in possession of the American president's words, the promise of a new nation founded on the proposition that all men are created equal. It is indeed a remarkable realization that in Sweden, when these words are delivered 150 years ago, was a 10-year-old boy who heard in them not only the American dream, but what became his own. 150 years later, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address does not look smaller in terms of the historical stage, but larger. A century and a half later, the Gettysburg Address is now recognized as the high watermark in American historical and political oratory. For that reason alone, it deserves our commemoration and appreciation today. Next, turning from the affirmation of democracy in America to a recognition of its absence elsewhere, we look to North Korea. Over the last several days, reports have come from that beleaguered nation that about 80 North Korean citizens were executed by firing squad on Sunday, November the 3rd. As Melanie Kirkpatrick reports for the Wall Street Journal, the worst came true this month for a handful of North Koreans who were caught with Bibles, which are outlawed by the communist regime. The Christians were among a group of 80 North Koreans who were executed by firing squad on Sunday, November the 3rd, according to a report in the South Korean Daily. Those who were put to death also included North Koreans accused of watching South Korean DVDs that have been smuggled into the North or of distributing pornography. The ruling Kim family regime controls every aspect of citizens' lives, including what information reaches them from the world outside North Korea's borders. Bibles, foreign DVDs, the internet, cell phones that can make international calls, all are banned. As Kirkpatrick reports, the executions were public and took place in at least 7 cities throughout North Korea. In the port city of Wonsan, 8 people were tied to the stake at a local stadium, had their heads covered with a white sack, and were shot with a machine gun. This while 10,000 spectators, including children, were forced to watch. As Kirkpatrick also writes, like his father Kim Jong-il and his grandfather Kim Il-sung, the new leader of North Korea understands the threat that Christianity poses to his rule. With its message of individual freedom, Christianity offers a potent alternative to the Kim family cult of personality. And what about that cult of personality? It is called Juche, and it is the official worship of the totalitarian dictator of North Korea. The grandfather, Kim Il-sung, mostly eradicated Christianity from North Korea in the 1950s and 60s. He employed a very brutal policy. He murdered religious leaders, imprisoned believers who wouldn't recant, and, as Kirkpatrick writes, banished others to remote regions. She then says, however, Christianity is now on the rise even in North Korea. They're learning about Christianity from countrymen who flee to China and receive help from Christians or from Bibles smuggled into the country, some of them by missionaries. But Kirkpatrick gets to the point when she says the only worship now permitted in North Korea is the worship of the Kim family and of its dictators. Every North Korean wears a badge over his heart displaying a photograph of the smiling face of Kim Il-sung. He, of course, is the grandfather of the current leader, and he was the founder of the totalitarian regime. This is a deeply troubling story, but it's really not all that surprising. This is not behavior that is outside the norm in North Korea. As a matter of fact, we've seen these recurring public executions as a way of trying to strike fear in the hearts of the North Korean people, and a fear, in particular in this case, from being tempted towards Christianity, much less the ownership of a Bible. Stories abound of people who are found with Bibles and then simply disappear, are sent into the infamous labor and concentration camps, or, as was the case on November the 3rd, executed by the scores in public. Melanie Kirkpatrick's account in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend ends with a very important paragraph. She writes, "The execution signaled that the regime is worried about the public's growing awareness of alternative worldviews and fearful of the potential for grassroots opposition to its rule. Christianity especially is a threat to the regime's survival. If more North Koreans decide to transfer their allegiance from the Kims to a different god, the regime's days may be numbered." End quote. To that we can simply say, take out the word may and say will. If anything is made evident by the murderous, paranoid action of the North Korean regime, it is that it fears Christianity. It fears the Bible. And its draconian and murderous policy is absolute proof of the fact that it is not only paranoid, but accurate in this one respect. It has good reason to be scared. Turning to the United States, Albuquerque, New Mexico is today ground zero in terms of the nation's battle over abortion. As Candy Carmarco of Tribune Newspaper reports, New Mexico's voters, those in Albuquerque, are going to be voting in an election today that will decide whether to ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. The measure going before the voters is entitled the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Ordinance. It needs only majority to pass, and it would have a statewide effect because the only late-term abortion providers in the state of New Mexico are in the city of Albuquerque. As a matter of fact, the abortion clinic now operating, offering late-term abortions there, is one of the most notorious in the country. Both sides in the nation's conflict over abortion see the measure today in Albuquerque as a crucial turning point. Those who are hoping for increased restrictions on abortion are looking to see if the citizens of Albuquerque will vote to make late-term abortion illegal. On the other hand, those in the pro-choice and pro-abortion camps are doing their very best to draw a line in the sand. Late-term abortions represent only a fraction of the total number of abortions done in America every year, but they represent a very crucial front in terms of the fight over abortion, precisely because the Roe v. Wade decision, handed down by the Supreme Court in 1973, explicitly says that the state may act to protect unborn human life in the third trimester. The issue of the 20-week cutoff is now something that is before the American people. This is very similar to the limit that was voted into law and then signed into law by the legislature and the governor in the state of Texas. Several other states have taken similar action. One of the reasons behind this is that current medical science is able, many now argue, to document the fact that the fetus feels pain at 20 weeks. A consistent and biblical affirmation of the sanctity and dignity of human life recognizes that that sacredness and dignity attaches to every human life at the moment of conception, not just at the moment that the fetus can experience pain. But the experience of pain has two functions in this. The first is legal, and the second is in reminding the voters of the city of Albuquerque that they're dealing with a baby here, not just with something that might be identified as a fetus. You would think that that would be a powerfully persuasive argument, morally speaking, for just about anyone. But as Stephen Dynan of the Washington Times reports, pro-choice advocates say science points to later in the pregnancy before a fetus could feel pain. And then he writes these astounding words. Doctors say even if they can feel pain, there are ways to mitigate it during an abortion, including with anesthesia. End quote. In other words, they're arguing first that the unborn baby really can't feel pain. And then they go on to argue, well, even if the baby can feel pain, it can be mitigated by anesthesia during an abortion. In other words, we will try to mitigate the pain while the murder of the unborn child is going on. What kind of moral logic is this? What kind of twisted society would actually engage in this kind of moral argumentation? Well, we better look in the mirror, because the mirror would show that in American society, this is one of the arguments now being made quite openly in public. We'll soon know if today it was a persuasive argument with the voters of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Finally, looking to the world of literature, Doris Lessing, who won the 2007 Nobel Prize for Literature, died at age 94 in London on Sunday. As her front page obituary in yesterday's edition of the New York Times explained, she was, quote, the uninhibited and outspoken novelist who won the 2007 Nobel Prize for a lifetime of writing that shattered convention, both social and artistic. There's more to it than that, of course. Doris Lessing is a symbol of the decadence of art in the 20th century, of the way that art imitated life in terms of the degeneration of the family, of marriage, and so many other moral concerns in the tragic 10 decades of the century now past. As the New York Times obituary explains, as a woman, she pursued her own interests and desires, professional, political, and sexual. Seeking what she considered a free life, she abandoned two young children. And that's exactly what she did. She fell in with a group of Marxists, and then as the Times explains, she decided to leave her children, her husband, and her home to pursue her ideals and life with her friends and comrades. She moved out of the family home to a rented room, took a job as a typist, and kept up with news of the children through a relative. Then she goes on and says about her married family life, I couldn't stand that life. It's this business of giving all the time, day and night, trying to conform to something you hate. All along, she said, she was planning to leave. And she said, quote, I'm going to commit the unforgivable and leave two small children, end quote. As the Times said, she also wrote that she was having an affair at the time, but did not consider it to be an important factor in her decision. Machiko Kukutani of the New York Times, reviewing the first volume of Doris Lessing's autobiography covering this particular incident, spoke of what she called her matter-of-fact tone. She also said that it leaves, quote, a vivid, if somewhat chilling, picture of the author as a self-absorbed and heedless young woman, end quote. There is more to the story of Doris Lessing, but the lesson for us is this. We're talking about a woman who won the Nobel Prize for Literature, is held up in terms of her art and her literature as an example of where the culture should mark its aspirations, certainly in the 20th century. But what we're looking at here is a very clear reflection of the fact that our art is ourselves and we are our art as a culture and as a society. Individuals become what they read, they reveal who they are when they write, and cultures become what they celebrate. The death of Doris Lessing in London on Sunday is a powerful reminder of those very important truths. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Baltimore, Maryland, where I'm here for meetings of the Evangelical Theological Society. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.